Today on Political Rewind, Democratic presidential candidates are heading to Georgia for a debate. The Trump administration rolls out tough new measures on immigration. And how are women driving the impeachment debate forward? Political Rewind starts now.
Thanks for being with us for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm going to get right to the panel because this is one of those days when we've got so much to talk about, we'll never get everything we need to discuss in. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is here. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the newspaper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog. Want to give you a chance to do a quick plug. You have a column that's up online right now, but it'll be in the Sunday paper. What is it about?
On the politics of transportation in Georgia, and it's not red versus blue.
All right, we will look for that, and that's a subject we can talk about on the show next week. I'm glad we've got that to look forward to. Ed Lindsay is here, former state representative, Republican state representative from Atlanta, yeah. Now a partner with the world's largest law firm, Dentons. Ed, you know I love saying that.
I know you do, and man, we appreciate you saying it.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Patricia Murphy is back with us. She worked on the Hill for people like Max Cleland, Sam Nunn, then crossed over to the dark side, became a journalist. And
or the light side.
Whatever we'll go either way on that. You have a syndicated column. I read you in Roll Call. And a little later in the show, I want to talk a bit about your most recent column about the women driving impeachment.
Thank you.
Also with us today, one of the Southeast's best known, most respected immigration attorneys, Charles Cook. Chuck, you know, when we talked about having you on the show, we thought we're going to put immigration at the top of the show. Not so much. But that's all right. You can talk to us about a lot, and we'll talk about immigration
That'd
as
be great.
We move forward. Jim, let's start with the big news this week for Georgia, at least for some Georgians. The Democratic Party, the DNC, has announced they're going to bring their presidential debate to Georgia on November 20th. There's one next week on October 15th, and then we're next in line.
Yep, we don't know how many candidates are going to qualify, and I'm not even sure that the requirements are out there yet. I guess the most important first of all, it's sponsored by the Washington Post and MSNBC.
And MSNBC.
One of the most important questions from a local point of view is, where is it going to be held?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, the question is, I mean, the last one in 1992, where you were a part of,
yeah.
That was held at the Carter Center. But if you're a Georgia Democrat right now, do you want to push it out to the frontier? Do you want to hold that debate out in Cobb County or North Fulton or Gwinnett, just to kind of put your mark out there?
Well, Patricia, I know that there are people looking, of course, at that right now. I talked to a couple of Democratic officials this morning who said they're going to meet over the weekend and hope next week they'll be able to announce the venue. But I think it's safe to say they're not going somewhere in rural Georgia. They're not going down to Moultrie. And the chances of going to a venue, say, in downtown or midtown Atlanta, it's possible, but I'm not sure what advantage they'd get out of that.
I think I could see them doing the Northern Arc. I mean, that would make the most sense. That's the area where they've had the most recent success. They've seen their ability to pick up the most votes. And it also, wherever the venue is, the good news for Democrats and Democratic voters or Democratic curious voters is that all of those candidates will more than likely be doing events right around those same areas. So you want to make it a place that's easy to get to, logistically sound, and that is the target area of the voters that you want to reach.
Mm-hmm. Ed?
Well, actually, I'm going to give you a counter argument.
Okay.
The base for the Democratic Party in Georgia are African Americans, and I'm surprised there hasn't been more discussion about Atlanta University campus.
That's an interesting idea.
Which is downtown, easy in, easy out for the candidates, and is real close to where most of the Democratic voters will be in the upcoming primary in
And Morehouse
March.
Has got a couple excellent venues
and
there.
And they do. Yeah. They do. So I'm surprised there hasn't been more discussion along those lines.
Well, we should point out that this is journalists right now speculating, not just us, but it's but your folks at the AJC have speculated. We don't really know what the thinking is yet. So they may, in fact, be certainly thinking about that. I do think one of the venues that's been discussed, Chuck, that's interesting is the big new performing arts center in that Sandy Rusty Springs. Paul built up in Sandy Springs.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. What a great location if you want to put it in a rising Democratic area with money.
Yeah.
And access to quick fundraisers, access to bringing votes into that District 6, which is the, one of the primary targets of the Republican Party. I think that's a very interesting place to have it.
And remember that Rusty Paul is, even though he runs for mayor in a nonpartisan role, a longtime Republican. Correct. It would be fun to see him have to host it up there.
Here's one other thing to think about here. Okay, the debate is going to be November 22nd. Democrats have said that they're going to, House Democrats have said that they are, the timetable for impeachment is before Thanksgiving. This debate will be held a week before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So we're going to see, this debate is probably going to be conducted in the midst of some fairly high drama in D.C.
All right. So, by the way, it's November 20th. Mm-hmm. Patricia, okay, we don't know what the venue is. We don't know anything about the details of how they're going to put it together. I think they do have the criteria for how a candidate will qualify at this point. Maybe if we can post that on our social media, the criteria that Sam, you put together for us, rather than going through all of it, that'd be terrific. But Patricia, aside from all of that, what impact is having a debate in the state? What, first of all, what does it tell us about how seriously the DNC takes Georgia? And then what impact do we imagine it has on voters to have a debate here?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple good things for Georgia Democrats that they're coming here. It is a signal, if you look at the other states where they've been having the debates, Michigan, Texas, mm-hmm. Ohio, Florida, all really crucial, important swing states. Georgia has really not made that list for Democrats in about 20 years. It just has not been a battleground that Democrats are willing to invest in and pay attention to. And so the fact that it's here says, yeah, we actually think it's worth coming. We mm-hmm. think it's worth investing in Georgia. I think it also gives a boost just to the morale of the state and to the visibility of the state, and especially for the campaigns. When you're getting that close to Iowa and New Hampshire, it is really hard to get candidates off of the trail in some of those key early states. Even South Carolina, it's very hard to get them to cross the state line and come
Great
to Georgia.
Point. Great
so
point.
Those Democratic candidates, the very tippy-top tier who would otherwise be in Iowa or New Hampshire, will be here in Georgia, and they would be smart to spend some time here. I would expect most of them will.
You know, I agree that you have a big event in a state that tells people that you're paying attention. And the flip side of that kind of occurred this spring with the Georgia GOP. We had a race for the chairmanship, mm-hmm. and one of the key promises made by all candidates is the pursuit of a national convention in Atlanta in 2024,
right.
which tells you they think the state's in play, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what, Ed, it strikes me that Republicans will have to come up with some kind of counter effort. We're going to have so much attention on the Democratic Party here, the candidates here. Yeah. What do you do if you're David Schaefer, the chair of the Republican Party here? How do you counter program?
Well, I think the key for David is to utilize this as a selling point for we've got to get our own act together. Yeah. We've got to build our grassroots campaign. And a big part of David's election last May at the state convention was his pledge not only to be a fundraiser, but to also reinvigorate the grassroots. And they're going to use this as a rallying cry going, Democrats think they can take Georgia. By God, they're not going to be able to. And we're going to build a grassroots campaign second to none.
Chuck, one of the other things that's important, I think, for Democrats to win this debate here is we've heard from Nikema Williams, the chair of the Democratic Party, Party. We've heard from candidates like John Ossoff and other Democrats who have said, you're not paying enough attention to us, national Democrats. We need more resources. We need more man and woman power. We need more funds coming into the state. This at least moves in the right direction for those people in the state. Democrats in the state have been worrying they're not going to get the attention they
need. I
think
it not only focuses that attention, but I think Stacey Abrams plays a part in the role that she played here in the close election for governor. They want to, I think the national Democrats want to say, look, we're paying attention to you. We understand that Georgia can be in play. I think this is going to be a boon for both parties. It wouldn't surprise me if Trump comes a week later before Thanksgiving, has a big rally down here.
Or the night before.
I mean, so this, I think it's fun as somebody involved in politics in Georgia to see this, both parties investing in our state.
Well, okay, Jim, I know the AJC is going to be all over this thing in the weeks ahead, and certainly we at GPB are already starting to make plans for how we're going to deal with this. But you mentioned the 19th. I think it's true that 1992 is the last year that we had a Democratic presidential debate here in Georgia. As you pointed out, it was at the Carter Center. You, I think, are the one who dug up some video from that debate.
I dug up the video on C-SPAN.
Let's look at it while you're talking.
I would also tell you that I have ticket number one to that event.
Oh, you do? Here we go. This is from 1992. Let's listen for just a minute.
Now, 8 years later, one of the cornerstones of your campaign is a middle-class tax cut. And yet, you're getting an extremely strong challenge from Paul Tsongas, who says that you want to be Santa Claus. He says no tax cuts. If the mood of the public is such that they're buying the message of Paul Tsongas, does it suggest that perhaps they feel that the tax cut idea is pandering to win votes?
Well, for one thing, you and others who have characterized that as the cornerstone of my economic message have misrepresented it.
But let's move on.
All right. Who is that handsome dude?
You know, who is it? Patricia, a lesson in how about asking shorter questions?
Bill, be proud of that moment.
Yeah, it's a great question.
But here's the point. That what we know about this, Jim, is that 1992 Georgia primary was what propelled Bill Clinton to the White House.
Zell had had timed that primary himself.
Yeah.
Because they shared James Carville and Paul Begala.
Yeah. Clinton had, despite what Carville and Begala tried to say made him the comeback kid in New Hampshire, the reality is, Patricia, he'd finished third in the New Hampshire primary. They came literally from Manchester to Atlanta to hold a rally at what was then the Omni at CNN, now CNN Center, and had the Georgia primary a week later because, as Jim points out, Zell Miller wanted to give him a jump start in the South.
And that was a really smart strategy on both their parts because that ended up being a really successful partnership. If you look ahead at this year's primary schedule, I do think Georgia is going to play another really big role because Joe Biden is in a little bit of trouble in Iowa, quite a bit of trouble in New Hampshire, and it looks like his firewall is going to have to be the South. It'll be South Carolina and then in his hopes on Super Tuesday, Georgia, other southern states, more diverse. He's going to really need, more than likely, a big boost from southern states. And so I think we'll start to see him more and more once the date starts to approach as well.
Can you do that? Remember Rudy Giuliani, when he launched his presidential campaign, you remember this well, Ed, as a Republican. He said, well, I'm not going to do well in Iowa. I'm not going to do well in New Hampshire. My firewall is Florida. Now, Florida came a little later in the cycle back then, but it didn't work.
No, it doesn't work. And the fact
I think
the fact of the matter is you got to play in either Iowa or New Hampshire. You don't necessarily need to win there, but you need to show that you're competitive there, because if you don't show you're competitive in one of those two states, by the time you get down south, a lot of the money and a lot of support starts drying up because folks start going, well, we want to back a winner. And so, you know, I think it's going to be incumbent of whoever is going to be the Democratic nominee. They got to play first, second, or third in either the Iowa or New Hampshire, and preferably both.
And you've got Nevada in there.
Nevada, too. Thank you very much. And those in particular before they get south, or they're not going to be in the campaign.
Yeah, You know, Chuck, we have not seen any polling recently in Georgia, although I am told by the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution we're going to see it fairly soon. Okay. So we're kind of looking at South Carolina in terms of Democratic voters as having a fairly similar composition of voters.
I think that's probably true for them.
And what's been fascinating to watch there is that even as President Trump has been pounding away at the alleged corruption of Joe and Hunter Biden in Ukraine, the polling in South Carolina, the national polls continue to show Biden riding high. And I would guess, given, again, the similarities in some of the voter composition, the same might be true here, and we'll find out soon
enough.
Well,
it's kind of interesting. I mean, Biden's, both him and his wife have been here in the last couple of months. He clearly views Georgia as quite important as his campaign. The query is whether Trump kind of got his powder wet a little too early against Biden, because it's not having an effect. And even though Elizabeth Warren's catching up a little bit, it's not because Biden's losing voters. He's just getting it from other places. So I think this could come down to a three-person, certainly a two-person race by the time it gets to Georgia.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we talk for a few minutes before we take a break about the latest news in impeachment without, I hope, going down the rabbit hole? Because I feel like every time we try to talk at all about impeachment, that's the rest of the show. But let's just talk about the developments of this morning. Marie Yovanovitch, who was the ambassador to Ukraine, who Trump summarily fired, testified this morning in a closed-door session, Patricia, with the three committees, right? Mm-hmm. Intelligence, Foreign Relations,
and Oversight.
And she basically said that she said the State Department attacked her, that they came up with allegations that she was disloyal to Mr. Trump, circulated by allies of Rudolph Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer. The charges were totally fictitious, she said. And here's a quote, "I do not know Mr. Giuliani's motives for attacking me. He may well have believed that their personal financial ambitions," meaning Giuliani and his friends, "were stymied by our anti-corruption campaign in Ukraine." That's from her opening statement, which the New York Times and Washington Post got a hold of.
Yeah, I will say what I've been surprised about so far in this Ukrainian piece of the impeachment story is how much there continues to be there. Yeah. And you look at what also happened on Friday with two of Giuliani's associates, his clients. In fact, his confidants from the Ukraine were arrested by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Moments after they had lunch at the Trump Hotel with Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, it doesn't get much worse than what happened at Galloway.
No, except for the fact that they were at the airport with one-way
tickets. Yeah. Go ahead,
and
Patricia.
They run a company that's literally called Fraud Guarantee.
Yeah.
And this is the man that Giuliani has been working with. They also were a part of Yovanovitch's dismissal as the ambassador there. And that was also a portion of the scheme that they're under investigation for, were campaign finance violations, funneling foreign money to members of the House, Senate, and even state offices to advance their own interests.
And to put pressure on the administration to get rid of Yovanovitch.
Mm-hmm. Which she was. Yeah. Now, when you go back in time, House Democrats knew that she had been sent back. This was of concern to members of House Foreign Relations for some time. So the fact that she is now coming in and testifying has been something they've been looking forward to for some time. It's also, to me, why Nancy Pelosi has wanted to focus on the Ukrainian piece of all of the things that they can investigate Trump for. The Ukrainian situation is a deep well of potential for Democrats and potential danger for the president. And so the Yovanovitch removal from the Ukraine, the Giuliani connection, not just to these two men who were arrested, but they were then the ones doing the information digging in Ukraine on Joe Biden. And that's what the impeachment is surrounding. And she was also, by the way, mentioned specifically by name by the president, mm-hmm, in his call with the Ukrainian,
yeah,
president.
So exactly.
Was that a perfect call? That's what this is all about. And she was
perfect
one of the few
whom?
People mentioned by name other than Joe Biden and Hunter Biden.
Ed, are we going to begin seeing any cracks in the Republican ranks up on the Hill? And let's talk, yeah, specifically about Georgians.
At the present time, no. On the issue of impeachment, you may very well have more people say that they're concerned about this policy action by the president, whether or not they thought
Syria.
The Yeah. Well, not just Syria, but also with the Ukraine, whether or not they thought the call was appropriate, mm-hmm. whether or not they thought that perhaps the policy behind what was being advocated in Ukraine was the right policy. You may very well start seeing some discussions along those lines, but that's a far cry from suddenly start discussing whether or not impeachment is proper or not. It's one thing to question policies of the president, and Georgia senators and representatives are starting to show some concern over that when it comes to Syria. It's another thing to start saying, well, we disagree with... not only do we disagree with the president on policy, we also think he's vulnerable for impeachment. The Democrats really need to be sort of shifting how they're going to go about it if they ever want to really start getting any kind of significant Republican support for either impeachment or conviction. And basically, it's along the lines of they got to start looking at the Nixon model that mm-hmm. took place in 73 and 74, in which means Republicans were brought in. Republicans, for instance, were allowed to issue subpoenas. They were allowed to bring in their own witnesses.
Baker was a very important part.
They were allowed to ask questions. They brought Nixon's lawyers in, so that the American people saw both sides of the issue. Right now, the Democrats, for whatever reason, are holding a tight rein on what kind of information is getting out and who's going to be listened to. And that gets back to your excellent article that you had earlier this week, mm-hmm. Dealing with some of the problems that some of the Democrats are having in terms of being able to handle the impeachment proceedings.
I'm sorry, Ed. Chuck, in the middle of all this, the president surprises everyone by announcing this policy of pulling U.S. troops out of northern Syria, allowing the Turks to do exactly what they've now done, mm-hmm. move in and presumably attack the Kurdish forces that are there. And it strikes a lot of people that when Ed said, you know, maybe not impeachment in terms of some of the issues Democrats are bringing up, but this is the sort of thing the Republicans have spoken out about very strongly, and it does seem to me it undermines him in some ways that could start Republicans thinking about whether they really don't need to move forward with this impeachment.
You know, it's interesting. If you think of the Senate as jurors, why would you anger jurors when they're going to hear your case in a few months? I mean, I don't have any doubt the House will end up voting for impeachment. And you have people that have been staunch Trump allies or quasi-staunch Trump allies like Graham or Rubio coming out very aggressively against the president. Now, Marco didn't put the president's Twitter handle in his tweet, but it was a very aggressive tweet. And it's interesting to see, is there a greater plan or is this simply, I only have a few months left, so I'm going to do everything I possibly can before I go? It's a strategy I can't quite figure out.
Jim, I think Chuck just said something important, and Patricia, you too should weigh in on this. Do we have any reason to believe at this point that we're not going to see articles of impeachment passed by the House?
I would put it at probably 90%. I'm not going to say absolute, but I think it's a pretty sure bet. You've got enough information out there on the table to let people know that there's something there. And what Yovanovitch's appearance today shows that the Trump administration doesn't have complete control over this situation as it did with the Mueller report. Mm-hmm. It's not controlling the bureaucracy in the way that it did the Justice Department.
I agree. Nancy Pelosi has said that what President Trump has said in his own words, including from the south lawn of the White House, she considers to be impeachable offenses, reaching out to foreign governments, encouraging investigations into your own political rivals, even seeing the name of an American citizen in a transcript of a phone call like that is so unusual. There's no way to really describe how far afield from not just normal, but potentially legal, that kind of conduct is. Yeah. And so for people who have been in D.C. a long time, the president paints them as swamp creatures, but they also are people who are used to and knowledgeable of the laws that govern this kind of activity as well. And so I think Pelosi is there on impeachment for sure.
All right, we're going to have to get to a break, but one last quick point before we do. And I'll throw this out. Well, Jim, you're the journalist at the table. I'm not sure that a great
man... What am I, chopped liver?
I'm sorry.
I wish to defend the honor.
I'll tell my editors.
All right. What I meant by I guess I didn't mean anything except I still think of you as being kind of straddling both sides, but you don't anymore. I apologize.
Try not to. No worries.
All right, you two journalists. Do you think the American people really understand the difference between impeachment in the House and what that really means? I think in some ways that Trump, a strategy is to confuse that issue. Impeachment is not the move that takes a president out of office.
Nor is it a coup d'etat.
Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons that you saw Nancy Pelosi here in Atlanta last week. She's got multiple stops across the country as long as this recess continues. And part of her job is to teach people impeachment.
Journalist Patricia Murphy, before we go, explain how this works.
Well, the articles of impeachment would be drafted by the House Judiciary Committee. Those would come up for vote in the Judiciary Committee. Democrats have the majority, so they would most certainly have the votes to get that out of committee. It would go to the House floor for official impeachment. I think that the public will understand the difference between that because the Clinton impeachment wasn't so very long ago. I think, even in my conversations with people, they understand the difference.
Okay.
Then it goes over to the Senate, and it's a very high bar. It's a two-thirds vote in the Senate. When Chuck was talking about the jurors over there, some senators have actually said, I don't want to comment on this. I may be a juror in the impeachment trial.
Yeah,
and that is a very, very big deal.
Yeah.
And the bar to get to two-thirds, including what would be essentially a majority of the Republican caucus, to me, is a very, very high bar. But it's intended to be by the framers.
Impeachment is the indictment in the House. The trial takes place in the Senate.
The trial takes place
never in the
Senate.
History of the U.S. has a president been removed from office
conviction by the
procedure.
Senate.
Yeah.
All right, let's do this. Let's get a break in. And while we're breaking, I am going to do everything I can to apologize to Patricia Murphy for that terrible oversight. We'll be back in a minute.
Isn't North Korea already posing an unacceptable threat?
As this regime continues to perfect its long-range nuclear capabilities, it's just a risk that the world cannot tolerate.
One out of every four times a fire truck leaves the station, it's for an overdose case.
So this House bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. If that is the only bill in town, that means we will have a shutdown.
A Seat at the Table is a weekly series hosted by Deneen Milner, Christine White, and Monica Pearson. The mission of A Seat at the Table is to let African-American women have a platform to educate communities about the Black woman's experience, life, and journey.
Today, we're talking about using the N-word.
Is a college education still necessary in today's world?
Today, we're talking about what it means to be folk.
From credit to entrepreneurship, Black women are about our business.
Join us for A Seat at the Table on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Patricia, let me go to this column and let me jump around a little bit in our format today. You wrote a really wonderful column, your syndicated column. I said earlier, I read you in Roll Call. You wrote it about the women who are in many ways driving impeachment. And of course, we know Nancy Pelosi is on top of all that. But you told us about another fascinating person, too. Talk about what you did in that column.
I was looking at the specific pressure points of impeachment. How did we get here? What's different from now versus 6 months ago versus 9 months ago?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Democratic voters have always been against this president, but what has changed to get us to where we are in this really unusual, unprecedented point? And if you look at those specific pressure points, I have just noticed that women have been at the center of most of those. And I'm not really talking about Pelosi, although she's been leading it for the Democrats in some cases reluctantly. But one woman is named Lindsay Boylan, who most Georgians are not going to know who that is, but she is Congressman Jerry Nadler's primary opponent in New York City. And most members of Congress can deal with impeachment, go home, take a break, especially if you're in a really strongly Democratic district. The president has a 71% disapproval rating in New York City. So Jerry Nadler in the old days would go home and people would just high-five him for being there and being a Democrat. Lindsay Boylan is really pushing Jerry Nadler and has been since last year on impeachment. Why aren't you doing more to impeach the president? Jerry Nadler is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which is responsible for impeaching the president. And so you started to see, as Lindsey Boylan's fundraising numbers and poll numbers have been going up, Jerry Nadler starting to get a real squeeze on him. He's a close ally of Pelosi's and had not come out for impeachment. And then as Boylan has been so aggressive specifically on this issue and saying, what are you even doing there? You're in charge. You could do it. We want to get rid of him. You're doing nothing for that. He's become much more aggressive, and I would say that is a byproduct, if not a direct result.
Interesting. Ed?
Well, a journalist, Patricia, raises an interesting point. We always talk about cracks in the Republican base and the Republican Party in terms of the president, but your article also raises some cracks on the Democratic side in terms of their effectiveness. And the question is whether or not Democrats in this impeachment debate may very well win the battle. They have the votes in the House, but whether or not they lose the war, that would be the next election. And a lot will depend on how good and how fair the American people see as the process. And so far, neither Nadler or, quite frankly, Adam Schiff, with his attempted parody, have really instilled any kind of real confidence, even among Democrats in Congress, that they are up to the task of putting forth a strong argument that they have shown a certain fairness to the president.
Do you want to respond to that real quickly?
Well, I agree. I mean, in my column, I said the real duds so far for Democrats have been Nadler and Schiff, who, for reasons I will never understand, did go into this parody of what might have been the conversation between the president
and
the president
mistake.
Of Ukraine when we don't need a parody. Yeah. It is in black and white.
Yeah.
And the Democrats can possibly have the trust of the American public in order to go forward on this, because it's unprecedented and so unusual to be going down this road at this point in a president's tenure, so close to an election. They want to wrap it up quickly, but you have to maintain your dignity and your trustworthiness. And I think somebody like Nadler, who's getting pushed and had a terrible hearing with Corey Lewandowski walking all over him. And then with Schiff, with his opening statement, makes people say, who's in charge? What is this kangaroo court? And they've actually, Republicans have called it a kangaroo court as a result. The women, I think, have been quite responsible in their rhetoric, and some of the men have been way out there.
Yeah, you know, Chuck, we've talked about it on the show, and a couple of us have said that although Schiff made that terrible gaffe in parodizing what the president allegedly said on that phone call, it was clear that Nadler was not going to be the guy to take the lead on impeachment the way he handled the judiciary hearings. Not just Lewandowski, but in several cases, just not focused, not sharp, didn't have discipline over his Democratic
members. Which is why he drew a primary opponent.
And so it wasn't a surprise that it went over to Adam Schiff, was it?
No, not a surprise at all. And I would have expected more from Adam Schiff in this. Ed brought up an important point earlier. You're not going to get American support behind an impeachment unless you have public hearings. Simply don't understand why we keep having these closed-door hearings when the transcripts are released. They go out and talk to the press right away. You know, you need to really do learn that lesson from Watergate and let the public see what's going on.
Right. You need a bipartisan hearing where the questioning is done by staff attorneys on both sides.
Please. Yeah.
What's interesting, though, Jim, about the investigation, about the impeachment investigation shifting over to intelligence more than judiciary, is it's kind of taken Trump's strongest defender, most articulate, I think, defender among Republicans on the Hill, Doug Collins, out of the picture because they're not in judiciary at
this
point.
And because it's House intelligence, it also puts it behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And where the Corey Lewandowski's performances they have no weight
and feeds into the president's strongest argument that A, you're trying to overturn my popular election, and number two, we have an election next in 2020. Shouldn't we be focusing on my job performance at that time?
All right, let me move on for a few minutes, Jim. Let's talk a little bit about, you all wrote the other day a piece about David Perdue, and his effort now is bipartisan effort with his co-sponsor, Doug Jones, the Democrat from Alabama, who's been on this show, At least from Purdue's point of view, he's kind of sidestepping whether we need any gun regulations to put in place, which is obviously a controversial issue, especially for him. And now he's saying, no, we need to come up with some ways to help schools understand how to fortify themselves against violent intruders.
Right. And this kind of gets into what Ed was saying. And we don't know. Look, we don't know what how strong the president is going to be in November 2020. Right. So you do have, what I find interesting is you do have certain people, David Perdue among them, trying to build a kind of a persona of himself aside from Trump, his identity as a Trump ally. He is picking some pretty good issues to focus on. He's focusing on women. He's focusing on the northern metro Atlanta suburbs. And at the heart of that is school violence, is the worry over gun violence in public schools. That is a top concern of women in suburbia, and he is trying to address that as best he can without crossing the NRA with this bill that would set up a clearinghouse, if you will, for best practices as far as school design or personnel hiring, metal detectors, whatever. But the interesting thing is, of course, it helps Doug Jones over in Alabama as well, because
he's the co-sponsor of the bill.
He's a co-sponsor, and you know he's going to be attacked during his reelect as a socialist. He can point to David Perdue and say, "This is my fellow traveler."
And yet, Patricia, how much distance is David Perdue going to be able to put between himself and the president, given that he's been attached to the hip to him for the last 3 years?
I mean, it's going to be very tough. And when asked directly, he will support the president. Yeah. I would certainly assume. Yeah. And he has legitimately been one of the president's closest allies. I think it's too late to back the truck out of the delivery station. I mean, he's already there. But he has to do what he can. The only very limited polling that we've seen of David Perdue, though, is that he is more popular than the president in the state, particularly among women. He has a facade and a demeanor that is much less offensive to many women than the president does. Perdue is just a very erudite, pleasant person to see in action.
He looks great in denim.
Yeah, he looks great. That one jacket he wears. That one jacket.
He's got one.
So I think he can be successful in this effort, and it's the smart place to be. But in gun safety and school safety, women don't just want safe schools; they want safe communities. And so he can't cross the NRA, and that's why there's no mention of guns in that bill.
Yeah.
And I think women are going to want more on that. Is it a deal killer? No, but he can't. He has to do something on school safety.
Chuck, meanwhile, Lucy McBath up there in the 6th District is being asked over and over again by many people whether she supports and would vote for the impeachment of President Trump, assuming the articles come together properly. And she sort of answered the question in the sense that she says, well, remember, I did take this procedural vote
for moving forward.
And yet she had protesters show up at her offices, pro-Trump protesters who were angry about the fact that she's supporting impeachment of the president. She seems to be caught in the middle there,
just a little bit. To a certain extent, keep in mind that pro-Trump protesters are a minority in her district, at least according to the last election. She feels like she's spoken on it. She doesn't, over the years, has not dealt an entire political career with the press or with folks. I think she's kind of learning still a little bit. But at the end of the day, I don't think she just wants to dwell on the impeachment. I think she wants to move back to her issue, which is the issue of guns. And she's going to keep going back to that issue because that's what she felt she was elected on.
Well, you know, her twisting in the wind reminds me of a piece of advice I got right after I first got into the House, which State House, which was, look, if you got a tough vote coming up, as quickly as possible, come out and tell people exactly where you are, because at least that puts an end to your twisting in the wind. And who's ever giving her the advice of trying to maintain neutrality, I don't think is doing her any good. I don't believe there's anyone here that seriously thinks she's not going to vote for impeachment. In the long run, she's probably better off going ahead and laying out her position, whatever it may be, and then moving on. Because if you stand on the fence, It's a cold place to be.
Well, in light of that, I mean, it's a really good point, because if you know, the latest Fox News poll that came out said 51% of people support impeachment. Now, we don't have any polling here.
Support an impeachment inquiry.
Inquiry. And so we don't have, you know, a local polling here, but you have to, think about, that's probably reflective of that particular district as well. I would suspect in the next week or two, you'll probably hear from her talk about
that. So, I mean, she's going to have to cast her vote. And so, the sooner she can defend it, the better.
Jim, let me reframe that, but ask you to comment on the same question. So these last couple days, we've seen some interesting video from Jody Ernst in Iowa and from Cory Gardner in Colorado, two Republican members who were being peppered with questions by reporters as to whether or not they believed it was appropriate for the president to look for help in getting from a foreign government and getting help on an opponent, getting dirt on an opponent, and they wouldn't really answer the question. On the other side of the aisle, is Lucy McBath in a similar position or no?
You know, I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so, and simply because the polls aren't moving that way. The support for an impeachment inquiry and impeachment and removal itself is growing. It's if it were on the decline, I think you might have an argument there that she's going to be damaged. What you have to remember is the 6th district is a wealthy district, but it's also the most educated district, maybe the second
in the country.
Highest,
right?
Has the second highest, at least in the South, behind a district in Virginia. So these are people who read, they understand the news, and they're watching.
Patricia, I want you to weigh in before we get to another break.
Well, the biggest movement that we've seen in that growing approval of the concept of removing this president through impeachment is among college-educated white women. Yeah. Those are Lucy McBath voters in the 6th District. So I think she will, you know, you could see, envision how she would eventually end up there, and she'd probably be electorally safe. In the meantime, I do think there's actually a third way that she could say, I need more information. I'm concerned. I need more information. I think at least that shows some transparency that we're not getting from McBath right now, who is mostly just not wanting to answer any questions at all about it. I think more transparency in her thinking would be very helpful to her just to weather this storm. It might be very unpleasant right now.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. And when we come back, let's turn to Chuck Cook, our immigration expert on the panel, and talk about the latest in terms of the administration's approach to immigration. We'll be back after these messages.
Thing that is predictable is the unpredictability of Washington, D.C.
Is the Sunni-Shia divide about to explode wide open?
Neither side seems to appreciate that they're destroying the region.
What are you seeing as the most important thing that has to get done right now?
Developments in the Harvey Weinstein scandal.
Women who say the Hollywood mogul sexually harassed.
Luckily, there are a lot of women coming forward. If we don't take this moment in history, then we're letting a moment pass.
Don't miss it on GPB.
Well, we're glad to have you all back with us on Political Rewind. Chuck Cook, there have been some interesting developments in your world on the immigration front. Yeah. let me just reel off several of them, and then you pick up on what you want. Number one, we have a presidential proclamation that was issued on October 4th, I believe.
My birthday.
Suspends entry for immigrants who cannot demonstrate they have health insurance or will have health insurance within 30 mm-hmm. days of entering the country. That obviously applies to immigrants who are looking to come in on
those
visas.
Those are immigrants coming in on actual immigrant visas. Not visitor visas, but immigrant visas. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 70, 80,000 a year come in that way from abroad. Most of them are family-type immigration as opposed to business immigration.
And what are the chances that those are people who will... Where do they get their health insurance?
Well, actually, you go on Google. And you can buy health insurance as a newly arrived immigrant. The insurance is good for 364 days. To keep in mind, you can't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid or any public benefits until you've been a permanent resident for 5 years. This only talks about having insurance at the moment you're appearing at the U.S. consulate.
So then what's the impact of this?
I mean, people have talked about this horrible impact. I don't think it's that big an impact because you can get the insurance. And you can also cancel it the week you get here. I mean, no, they're not going to be any follow-up about that. So I don't think it has an immediate real impact other than scaring people. But at the same time, the irony, of course, is presidents mandating health insurance for people when, you know, we have this whole fight over the whole ACA thing. But the other thing is there is litigation pending on that. There's already been a lawsuit that's getting filed. I don't expect that will go into effect. The reason is the president is relying on a particular provision in immigration law that the Supreme Court ultimately held was sufficient to sustain what we call the Muslim ban, the travel ban mostly from Iran. But the Supreme Court read that very narrowly and required a great deal of justification. This proclamation simply doesn't have it. So I think there's a really strong likelihood that this actually provision will actually be struck down and stayed by a district court, and we'll go through the whole thing again back up to the Supreme Court in a couple of years.
The Justice Department has promulgated a rule. I don't know that it's actually gone into effect or not, DNA collection of immigrants who are detained at the border.
Yeah, that's actually not a surprise. It's from DHS. So anybody who applies for asylum or is detained at the border, they'll take a mouth swab and put it into the federal DNA database. The federal government's been doing this for years for prisoners in the federal prison system. So this is not something new. Again, it's meant to send a signal. It's not necessarily the use you get out of it, but it's the message you get from it. And when you're going to take my DNA, the idea that, oh, I'm not going to come to America, you're going to take my DNA. That's not stopping anybody from coming to the border who's fleeing for their life from El Salvador.
Is this being used to ascertain whether family members are truly family members?
Well, no, actually, that's not being used for that. They actually using crazier tests than DNA for that, that I'll talk about in a second. No, this is actually meant to send the message, well, these are potential criminals, and we may need their DNA in the future in case they rape or murder somebody. That's the message this is. It has no other utility within the immigration system at all. Now, as far as, you know, testing, is this really my child at the border? They're using all kinds of interesting tests other than DNA, including whether they look like each other. For determining ages of children, they're looking at the size of their teeth or their length of their forearm, and wildly discredited science. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going down at the border right now. On that, yes, I know. It's absolutely crazy.
Ed, all of this are these kind of scattershot efforts that smack of Stephen Miller's influence on the West Wing, on the Oval Office.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that Stephen Miller footprint or shadow has a big impact on immigration, both within the White House and with the Department of Homeland Security.
Patricia, when you hear about these, and there are others, I know you want to get to one that you think is more important, but this ongoing war is certainly going to be something the president will showcase in the 2020 campaign in a big way.
It was a big part of why he got elected in 2016. Yep. It was a central focus of every rally that he held. It was not the focus of his very first rally, but after he heard the applause that he got from the crowd when he started talking about illegal immigration, immigrants are thieves, immigrants are murderers, rapists, and I'm sure some are nice people, the kind of response that he got fed back to him by his core base supporters has fed the oxygen of his thinking on this. And then somebody like Stephen Miller comes in and says, well, here are all the things you can do to hit the gas on this. And so immigration and attacking immigrants, demeaning immigrants, it is, I think, just a core piece of what he's always done in campaigns. What I find fascinating about some of these new pieces of policy, Republicans typically will say we need to reduce illegal immigration and increase legal immigration.
Yeah.
The president is now demonizing both legal and illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
And so that is a major change for the Republican Party, but it's something that some members of his base have felt for many years.
You know, we hear all the times that, I'm in favor of legal immigration.
Yeah.
That's exactly who this is against. The DNA is from legal immigrants legally seeking asylum. The DNA, the public health insurance is from legal immigrants been waiting in line. So it's an interesting twist on what's been going on.
But then you have Democrats choosing to veer hard to the left on the issue.
Well, the Democratic debates, the question is, and, would you give health care to illegal immigrants?
Will you decriminalize crossing the border illegally? Along those lines that have, for whatever reason, lurched the Democratic Party hard to the left. And so as a result, you've got the middle ground almost a no man's land.
You know, Jim, I noted what Ed's saying is so correct. I mean, if you watched the first Democratic debate when some of these things really came out, it seemed to me like an exercise, a perfect example of groupthink. I'm not sure that any one of those people might have necessarily immediately embraced the notion of, you know, decriminalizing border crossings.
There's been some backpeddling on that.
But it's out there.
But I will tell you what. I watched Donald Trump's rally in Minneapolis yesterday.
Yeah.
And when he is speaking to a virtually all white crowd and talking about legitimate Somali refugees and is getting the response he's getting, that begins to get the rhetoric that we're hearing and the actions that we're seeing on this kind of have a different flavor to them.
And we haven't even mentioned that he just announced that they're cutting in half the number of refugees who are going to be allowed
in the United States. Cutting in half from the already
from
cut
nothing,
in half.
From, I say, 18,000?
We had 75 the last year under President Obama. Mm-hmm. This year went down to 50. Next year, 30 this year, 50, 30, now 18,000.
Yeah.
That's essentially nothing.
What's the worst thing that you've seen? You walked in here and said you didn't even talk about the thing that I'm most concerned about.
First, we didn't talk about public charge. This is the new rule in our immigration laws since 1882. There's been a rule that says if you're going to become a public charge, in the old words, you can't come in America. And it's always been interpreted very, very loosely, but it's a very powerful phrase. Now they've actually put into regulation very specific guidance on this, including yesterday the Department of State in their new rules said, if the consular officer interviewing you for a green card believes that you will ever become a public charge, he will deny you. Think about this. Everybody will ultimately become a public charge. Mm. We're all going to be on Social Security. We're all going to be it, right? So therefore, you could literally deny everybody. But there's another piece of legislation that's actually not from the president. It's actually coming out of the House. Actually, there is immigration legislation on the floor of the Senate right now. About 4 months ago, the House passed a bill called House Bill 1044, which removes something called the per country limit. Now, this is really weedy, but it's really important. In our legal immigration system, which was really established in 1965, they said something really simple. Everybody's going to get an equal chance to come. And they did that because we had a very race-based immigration process for like 47 years. Mm-hmm. So that every country has a chance to come, and no country can have more than 7% of the numbers for green cards, whether it be family or business. And it's been that way for the last 50 years. One country got really out of whack in the last 15 years on the employment side. And this is a result of H-1B visas and H-1B visa abuse. So a lot of Indian nationals began to apply for green cards. And today, there's a 30 to 40-year wait for green cards for Indian nationals working in the United States. And they've managed to convince Zoloftgren in the House, and it passed the House on a voice vote to eliminate the per-country limit. So we all thought, well, this is going to die in the Senate. Nothing ever dies in the Senate and the House. And in fact, Senator Lee from Utah, apparently because of the Silicon Slopes that have developed out in the state of Utah, has pushed the bill, has what's called Senate Bill 386. And it came up for unanimous consent motion 2 weeks ago. And interestingly enough, it didn't pass because our Senator Perdue stopped it. Now, when I heard that Senator Perdue stopped it, I thought, well, he's very anti-immigrant. He's carried the president's water. That's not why he stopped the bill. He stopped the bill because the hospital association called him and said, hey, what about all the nurses we need? And so he worked out a deal with Senator Lee, and they amended the bill and said there's a set aside for nurses going forward.
We're running close out of time. So how do you know that this is what his motive was?
I talked to his chief of staff.
All right, so you've got that directly from them. What's the bottom line implication?
The bottom line is the House will come back and vote.
What happens with all this?
Well, basically, we will only have Indian immigrants in employment-based jobs for the next decade.
But businesses have pushed for that, haven't
they? This is a push for that. So basically, nobody from any other country in the world will be able to immigrate through employment for the next decade. That's what this bill does.
And this is reflected. You do see a big, a very tight relationship developing between the Republican Party and Indian immigrants.
That's right. That's it.
It's very interesting to watch.
We're out of time for today's show. Chuck Cook, thank you for being here. Ed Lindsay, a pleasure to have you. Yeah. Jim Galloway, thank you. I'll see you again for the Monday Political Rewind. And Patricia Murphy, thank you for being here. And again, my apologies.
Well, you have been my favorite colleague over the last 5 years.
Until today. that's it for us. We are completely out of time for today's show, but we really appreciate your being with us. One last note. I said this a week ago, and I want to say it again today. We are still tinkering with how much to talk about impeachment, which, of course, is the biggest issue on the national political stage today. But we also want to continue to talk to you about what's happening in our state, Georgia. Give us your thoughts. We're trying to mix them up as well as we can, but why don't you let us know on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email? How would you like us to talk about impeachment? How would you like us to talk about state issues? We'd love your thoughts on that. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again for Political Rewind Monday at 2.
I need to call you.